It's only an ancillary point. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm sorry for the confusion getting started. To the question, what is Donald Trump worth? Two discordant answers come to mind, capturing in their dissonance the simple theme of this paper. One is, he's absolutely worthless, a sentiment which we immediately recognize as native to the academic professional class, whose hierarchy of esteem rests on credentials, artistic or scholarly or scientific achievement, and evidence, as we are trained to see it, of moral worth. The other way of looking at this question is a pure question of money, the precise quantity of which remains unknown because the president, a shrewd man, prefers to keep us guessing. It is possible that on a net basis in this realm, the same answer pertains, absolutely worthless. But that would be a serious matter and not merely a snide opinion. At times like this, I reach for my Veblen. Veblen reassures us that we are not in the grip of the novel and unfamiliar, but merely coming face to face with timeless realities that we might have preferred to repress. Quote, the motive that lies at the root of ownership is emulation. The possession of wealth confers honor. It is an invidious distinction. And it is even more to the point that property now becomes the most easily recognized evidence of a reputable degree of success as distinguished from heroic or signal achievement. It therefore becomes the conventional basis of esteem. The possession of goods, whether acquired aggressively by one's own exertion or passively by transmission through inheritance from others, becomes the conventional basis of reputability. The possession of wealth, which was at the outset valued simply as evidence of efficiency, becomes, in popular apprehension, itself intrinsically honorable and confers honor on its possessor. According to popular reward, the highest honors within human reach may even yet be those gained by an unfolding of extraordinary proficiency in war or by quasi-predatory efficiency in statecraft. That these passages describe the dominant political forces in our world is beyond doubt. A quasi-predatory efficiency in statecraft is the present ambition of a president initially forced on public awareness by display of wealth. Of wealth is proof. But the question remains, how did these forces become dominant in an ostensibly democratic and republican society, which had built up over the 20th century a doctrine of emancipation, equality, and middle-class ethos? Of the potential for this development, Veblen was fully aware. He saw the class divide between the industrial orders and the leisure class as a direct outgrowth of the gender divide, according to which from the earliest barbarian era, toil, as in child-rearing and then agriculture, was the female province. While what men did, as in hunting and warfare, was first of all a competition for honor and prepotence, a status game. Hence the liberation and enfranchisement of women and the rise of a scientific ethos of cause and effect in cumulative technical development under the potential guidance of a Soviet of engineers were the prospective, peaceable, and efficient alternative to rule by the leisure class. Let me suggest that for a certain time, a political alliance along these lines existed, encompassing organized labor, a peace movement, many women, and largely autonomous professional class, an uneasy alliance, but sufficient in the 30s, 40s, and 60s to form a ruling coalition, leaving the bulk of the leisure class to non-governmental pursuits, such as banking, real estate, and golf. At the time my generation entered the adult phase of our lives in the early 1970s, the coalition was already broken over the Vietnam War. Yet it was still possible to imagine that one might play a political role, largely on merit, and without first acquiring either vast wealth or the sponsorship of the wealthy. This illusion has now disappeared. The victim of rising inequality, married to Adam Smith's dictum that wealth is power, as Mr. Hobbes says. It's really the best sentence in the entire Wealth of Nations. So what happened to the Democratic Party? In phases, the destruction of the industrial core of the country and the rise of the finance technology axis, opposing the constellations of energy, agriculture, the military, and the media, but each contesting for power on a foundation of wealth. The alignment of the Democratic Party with new poles of wealth, abandoning the perceived interests of the working population in favor of trade deals, and more insidiously still, the quasi-privatization of social insurance. Three, the metamorphosis of the professional classes from an autonomous collective bound by shared ethics and values into the well-groomed servants of the new elites. Wealthy enough themselves, but not so much so as to be independent, rather just enough as to no longer require any political base amongst working Americans or to feel a need to retain those bonds such as they were. It would not do to claim that professional elites were ever entirely independent of personal wealth, but if you look at the Roosevelt and Kennedy eras, you see a different sort of relationship involving players equally at home in government or outside institutions that protected them from the need for personal wealth, as well as permanent civil servants in the mode of Harry Dexter White or Leon Henderson or Leon Kaiserling, whose access to power was direct and unmediated. This type is much less evident, with the result that academic professional participants in the higher reaches of the power game, however talented, are more or less necessarily vetted by and allied with critical poles of wealth and power in finance, technology, or energy, among others, while the institutions that formerly sheltered quasi-independent policy intellectuals have become stopping-off places for rest homes for members of the para-public servant class. To illustrate this point, consider the career profiles of the two candidates for president in 2016. Of the eventual victor, enough said, Trump's qualifications and his ostensible wealth are inseparable. A minor business figure could never have pulled it off. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, had an exemplary resume as what? First lady, senator by courtesy of a state in which she had never lived, a post to which she was elevated by connection, secretary of state by appointment. Whether she did those jobs well or poorly is beside the point. Her independent public career was the apex of place for an entitled professional, and it was arrived at in the first place by the pathway of first wife, America's premier position for a vicarious display of status. She was not and could never claim to be a representative of the predominantly female industrial orders, and indeed understood herself to have been isolated from those concerns by long separation. The result of the election in the decayed industrial states underscored this. I want to turn now just to the point that I wanted to illustrate with a few slides, which is that an analysis of the evolution of economic inequality at the level of the American state in relation to election outcomes can illustrate the characterization that I'm trying to offer. To carry out this work, the University of Texas Inequality Project team had first to develop, didn't exist because annual census is basically a too small, annual household surveys had too small sample sizes for the small states until 2000. And so we had to rely on decennial censuses, which were separated by 10 years each. So we had to first to develop annual measures of state-by-state inequality using detailed information from the employment and earnings data set and techniques previously developed for a global analysis. This done, what we did was to calculate the change in inequality in each state from 1990 to 2014, actually from 1969 onward, but the thing I'm going to show you is mainly 1990 to 2014, and plotted it against the 2016 election outcome, showing the states that went Democratic in blue diamonds, and the Republican states with red circles. So now we're going to see whether you can make this. This is the outcome by county, obviously.
Hang on.
All right. This is what it looks like if you take from 1969 through 1988 at the Dukakis-Bush, Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush election, and you can see there's really no meaningful relationship. Change in inequality, first of all, relatively small, and secondly, the states are all over the map in terms of how they played out in the election. If you go to the 2016 one, George can do it and I can't, it's just a mystery to me.
I'm familiar, sort of. Hang on.
You have warm fingers and mine have been outside.
Come on.
There we are. Go to the 2016. This is what the pattern looks like for the change in inequality state by state from 1990 to 2014. And what do you find? In an election which was characterized by what was at least on the surface a populist surge, the states, and the 14 states with the largest increase in inequality, do one more for me.
Yep. Sorry, give me a second.
There we are. Whoops, can we go back?
Did I go too far?
Just go up one more. Yeah, there we are. There we are, good. The 14 states with the largest increases in inequality, the symbols are weighted by the scale of their electoral votes, every single one of them voted for Hillary Clinton. Every one of them. And the states with the smallest increases in inequality predominantly voted for Donald Trump. Now, why was that? The answer surely is that election outcomes by state, which is what matters in the Electoral College of the United States, are not a matter of popular reaction against inequality, but artifacts of the demographic dynamics captured in part by the measure of inequality itself. States voting Democratic are those where the sum of socially liberal urban professionals and loyal minorities amount to a plurality. States voting Republican tend to be rural, suburban, and are able to keep their minority voting populations under control. The states migrating from Obama to Trump saw a combination of industrial decline, community dislocation, I think entirely unrelated to the foreclosure crisis, and vote suppression, tipping the balance toward Trump. In states where urban professional classes and minority populations are growing rapidly, notably across the South, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, but especially Texas, the balance moved toward Clinton, though not by enough to affect the result. And the combination of those two things is what gave you the narrow Electoral College victory of Donald Trump. The immediate consequence of the election is a cabinet of billionaires disciplined only by a leavening of generals, intent on demolition of the administrative state, tax cuts for corporations, definitive looting of public lands and wealth, indifference to climate change or any broader social responsibilities, and intent on locking in their present position through the courts and the election system. For the moment, the remnants of the professional political elites cling to the belief that personal antics and the unpopularity of the incumbent president, fortified in the last few days by the account of Mr. Michael Wolff, which really worth diverting your attention from these meetings to follow, will sweep them back into power. A realistic expectation at best is that they may obtain a further round in office as distinct from in power, but with neither the will nor the ability to effect any systematic reversal of present trends. Indeed, the structural detachment of these elites from a political base precludes even the development of an alternative economic program, and as you may have noticed, there isn't one, let alone its implementation. Moreover, the coalition in support of these remnants is geographically concentrated and fragile. A genuine program of redistribution toward working populations of all ethnicities would inevitably realign the sponsors of this elite remnant with the overt oligarchy, a process visibly underway already, leaving the politically active elements both without a base and underfunded. This is the risk that a Sanders 2020 candidacy must inevitably run and will not go away, even or especially if he wins. What then is the specific responsibility of the economists? At the level of the present day individuals, let us be charitable, it cannot be very much. The profession is on the sidelines, brushed away in this era of direct rule by the business class. We're not in the early Reagan years where the economists were actually confecting a massive ideology in behalf of what was happening. That's long in the rearview mirror. And this seems particularly true of conservative economists. There are hardly any left of any consequence except possibly in the field of law and economics where they are ensconced for life. True, the profession is replete with dull and thoughtless conservative ideologues. It is bereft of stature. The last conservative idea straggled out of Chicago or Stanford sometime in the early 1980s. To the extent that there is original thought in mainstream economics since then, it's predominantly been in a critique of neoclassical precepts, for example, from the behaviorists. Mainstream economics survives by a process of hierarchy construction and maintenance. Its intellectual ferment can be assessed by walking the halls at these meetings, which feature minute audiences in the large halls, and packed rooms on the fringes, but I digress. And yet, at some deeper cultural and political level, the historical responsibility of the economist has to be considered very great. And that is because economics sets a tone for the political culture, fostering a climate of thought with, among others, the following characteristics: a conceptualization of the isolated individual as the unit of observation and analysis, an isolated homunculus with neither antecedent nor consequent, a vision of that individual as the locus of material desires, nothing else, a vision of interactions brought to harmony out of an external balance of forces, supply and demand, imported with minor modifications from Confucius, a subrogation of the fundamental life forces including resource use, production of waste, entropy, organization, and hierarchy, and selection and recombination over time, and contempt for government, masking a deep non-comprehension of the role regulation plays in every organized system, whether biological, mechanical, or social. The economists are therefore professionals who have a unique role in that their doctrines deny the utility of all other professionals, scientists, engineers, lawyers, accountants, who serve the regulatory function. Economists serve to deprecate, to undermine, and to limit fact and science-based disciplines and functions, and to divert attention toward the transient and the ephemeral, self-improvement and job training as cures for unemployment and inequality come to mind as examples of the characteristic mode of thought. Economists therefore serve as enablers of the oligarchy, of the predator class, of the systems of direct rule under which we live. Having created a climate of benefit and cost, of price for everything from irreplaceable resources to human life to the future livability of the planet, economists serve as intellectual apologists for Trumpism, for the destruction of the Environmental Protection Agency, for the delegitimation of decision by voting, for the opening of public lands, for the use of commercial discount rates to assess the impact of the loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet in one or two centuries' time. So yes, in a broader sense, the responsibility is quite great. Thank you very much.